And now, it's time for the Talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning to you. 6 minutes past nine on this Thursday, the 21st of March. You're very welcome along to another edition of the 9 till noon show. And it was a long edition of the 9 till noon show yesterday because we stayed on air to bring you the bombshell news. You don't get big political news in this country at that level that often, I suppose. That Leo Varadkar was no longer going to be the leader of Fine Gael, no longer going to be the Taoiseach. He's going to stay on as a TD. And already the runners and riders are jockeying for position to replace him. We're going to be talking about that. Also very interested in your views. What do you believe his legacy will be? And that means in a good and a bad way as well, too. Are you happy that effectively Fine Gael will choose the next leader of the country? Or do you believe that is a decision that should be made by the public? And what that means, by the way, so we have to consider that, that means an election, a general election. Would you be up for a general election? Do you want to choose, I suppose, effectively, who the next leader of Ireland would be? Or are you happy enough for Fine Gael to do that and just run its course? Probably it will run its course now at this stage, I'd imagine, for the next year. I think tomorrow, actually, is the last day the general election can actually happen, believe it or not. But would you like a general election now and everything that goes with that? Or are you content for Fine Gael to select the next Taoiseach? And this would be this government choosing its third Taoiseach, effectively, because we've had rotation Taoiseach for the last couple of years, and this will be the third. Listen, it's going to be Simon Harris. There's just absolutely no question about that. And in fact, such is the strategy with how this has been put together. It's quite possible, I think, that no one will stand against Simon Harris because you'd be politically damaged in doing so. So there are obviously three or four big names there that certainly could contest the leadership of the party. But it's been so well coordinated over the last 18-odd hours that I think you would be damaged politically if you stood against Simon Harris in that party, if that makes sense. So it'll be interesting to see how it pans out. But as I say, I wouldn't be surprised. I can't see any benefit in anyone else at this point putting their name forward. But we shall see, because as I say, there are some people there that probably have their own aspirations, but they would come out of it weaker, I think, as a result. Tyrconnell Tribune this morning: the shock confirmation on Wednesday lunchtime that Leo Varadkar is stepping down as Taoiseach has sent the coalition into a tailspin, particularly coming on the back of the worst ever defeats in the two referendums. John McIntyre writes that after 7 years in office, I don't feel I'm the best person for that job anymore, he said. The appointment of the new Taoiseach will have to be ratified in the Dáil, however. 4 days, never mind 4 weeks, is a hurdle too far for speculation on that one. Of much more immediate concern for the party is the local and EU elections that are only 11 weeks away. Lots of detail and analysis from John McIntyre in that paper this morning. The Donegal News leads with the same story. The people of Donegal deserve an immediate change of government, not just a new Taoiseach, Sinn Féin TD Piers Doherty insists. His comments follow the shock announcement yesterday by Leo Varadkar that he's to stand down as Fine Gael leader and Taoiseach, with his successor to be in place within just 3 weeks on April 6th. What are we saying very clearly now is that we don't need a change of Taoiseach, we need a change of government, Deputy Doherty declared. It would not be down to a select, or it should not be down to a select few in Fine Gael to decide who runs the country. Let's go to the Derry News now. McGavigan family worry over Legacy Act. The family of a Derry teenager who was shot dead by the British Army in Derry in 1971 have issued a pre-action protocol letter against the Public Prosecution Service requesting a prosecutorial decision regarding a soldier alleged to have shot her. On to the Nationals now. And Harris, the early front runner for leader of Fine Gael with Donoghue in contention. As I say, I just feel that Pascal Donoghue, by putting himself forward, now he's seems to be out of the running, from that EU role now, because the lady that's in situ seems to be indicating that she's staying on. Pascal Donoghue, I think, just might be seen as a bit of a continuity candidate. You could say the same to some extent of Simon Harris, but I just feel that it would be politically unsound for Pascal Donoghue to put his name forward and to suffer a defeat in that regard. He might be a better place to rally in behind Mr. Harris. Well, Simon Harris is the early front runner to become the new leader of Fine Gael and Taoiseach after his cabinet colleague Simon Coveney ruled himself out of contention. However, coalition insiders said a contest for the leadership was a strong possibility. A Minister for Public Expenditure, Pascal Donoghue, in particular, should not be ruled out. Amid deep shock across the political system after Taoiseach Leo Varadkar announced he would stand down, speculation on who would succeed him centred on Minister for Further and Higher Education, Mr Harris, Minister for Enterprise, Mr Coveney, Minister for Social Protection, Heather Humphreys, though I can't help but feel her race is a little run at this point, and Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee, and Mr Donoghue. Aside from Mr Coveney, none had ruled themselves out of contention yesterday evening, with Government Chief Whip Hildegard Nocton and Minister of State for Finance, Financial Services, Jennifer Carroll McNeill, also refusing to be drawn. As I say, I don't bet, but I certainly wouldn't be betting against Simon Harris. So how is the next leader elected? We'll go to the Independent. Fine Gael will now select its next party leader, and Taoiseach, a senior Fine Gael source, said the procedure for electing the next leader would be the exact same as 2017 when Leo Varadkar took over from Enda Kenny. Even though the selection of the new leader then took more than a month, the new Taoiseach will be installed very quickly. In 2017, both Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney contested for the Fine Gael party leadership. Even though Mr Coveney won the members' vote by 2-1, Mr Varadkar's sway over the parliamentary party, that's TDs and senators, won him the electoral college vote, and as a result, the position of party leader. As set out in the Fine Gael constitution, the parliamentary party holds 65% of the voting weight. I'd forgotten, actually, that Leo Varadkar had lost the membership vote and that he got over the line thanks to senators and TDs. Again, that is another scenario which means that Simon Harris at this point would pretty much know he's a shoo-in for that. Other things, of course, going on in the world. The Irish Daily Mail tells us that a new report has advised the government to introduce legislation for assisted dying, but the chair of the committee that delivered the document has launched an alternative report. The Special Oireachtas Joint Committee on Assisted Dying recommendations are opposed by independent TD Michael Healy-Ray. The final report, published yesterday, advocated that assisted dying should be allowed in restricted circumstances, limited to those with 6 months to live or 12 months in the case of a person with a neurodegenerative disease, illness or condition. Now, again, this is where it gets complicated because can you clearly predict when someone is going to die, particularly from some of the conditions we're talking about here, and people perhaps could live long beyond the 12 months. But anyway, that report has led to a split in the committee after its chair, Mr. Healy-Ray, refused to support its recommendations. Three members of the committee, Mr. Healy-Ray, Fianna Fáil TD Robert Troy and Independent Senator Ronan Mullen, have claimed that the case for assisted dying has not been established. And such is the way it's... You see, there is these concerns, and as I say, I've heard from people very much in favour of assisted dying, and the arguments are incredibly compelling. But also, too, what I think the public need to talk about is what this means in terms of our attitude to death and dying more generally. You know, in terms of how we cope with it, how we deal with it, how we talk about it, how we provide care for it. And there are concerns within the medical professional that it could tip that in a different direction. And also, they're putting time limits, or they're suggesting time limits, that we don't become a suicide sort of destination, assisted dying destination, so that you'd have to have lived here for a certain amount of time before you could avail of that. Again, you know, this is all happening, all these conversations are taking place, and this is all moving forward. Are you all in favour of it? Are you opposing it? You know, it is time now to sort of have your say, I think. The Irish Farmers Journal, some 28,000 farmers could be exempt from CAP inspections and payment penalties under a new proposal from the European Commission. The Brussels plan to cut red tape around farmers' schemes would see all farmers below 10 hectare exempt from CAP inspections and payment penalties. Irish Farmers Journal analysis shows that the majority of farmers who would benefit from the move are beef and sheep farmers. Large numbers of farmers in counties Mayo, Galway, Donegal and Cork would be exempt. So it could be good news for Donegal farmers, providing you match that criteria. Obviously, the jury's out on vaping in terms of what damage it does to us. We simply do not know because not enough time has passed for people to know. Now, there's lots of people vaping. A lot of people are smokers and now vape because they don't want to smoke anymore. But unfortunately, and I see it all too often, and I find it very upsetting, is that there's a lot of young people who never smoked that are vaping now. What damage are they doing to themselves? Well, vaping may lead to cancer in the same way as smoking tobacco, according to a new study. E-cigarettes have soared in popularity as a way to help smokers quit, but it turns out that there may not be much difference in terms of health. Scientists have found that inhaling from a device that emits pure nicotine causes similar DNA changes to cells in the same way seen with cigarettes. Findings highlight the importance of studying the long-term consequences of vaping. And I'm not sure if it's across the board, but certainly in some documentation I've read, that if you're looking for life insurance, if you vape, you might as well be smoking. So it's clear that the life insurance companies, at least those that I was reading literature on, they're edging their bets because they view vaping as smoking. They don't care if it's a stop, if you've stopped smoking and now are vaping, or they don't care if you... And as well as that too, young people now, I wonder... if they don't declare that they're vaping, because obviously it's going to send the premium up, effectively their life insurance could be voided, couldn't it, if it turns out they did in fact vape. So there's a big area there in terms of life insurance, mortgage cover and all that type of stuff. Some of them certainly seem to see vaping the same as smoking. I wonder, do young people vaping who never smoked realise that that's the situation and the implications of that? They have to declare it. They can't say no, because if it's found that they do, well, you know, insurance companies are very keen to getting out on insurance policies. The Sun tells us that significantly more mothers than fathers find it hard to live up to society's expectations of parents, a study reveals. The Mammies and Daddies report, launched yesterday by Coin Research, reveals 61% of women and 42% of men find bringing up kids challenging. Very few of those with children under the age of 12, 4%, said it was easy to align with society's perception of being a good parent. Now, what is society's perception of being a good parent? Like, why are we always comparing ourselves to others? I mean, you know, you bring them up as best you can, don't you? And you give them the best opportunities. Like, who cares what society thinks? I don't mean that badly, but, you know, you do your absolute best and you care for them and you make sure they're safe and well as much as you can. Well, two-thirds of the 1,000 mums and dads surveyed said their finances had been negatively impacted by having children, of course. And more than half, 55% said their health had deteriorated. So do you feel, as a mum or a dad, it difficult to live up to society's expectations of being a parent? Again, I don't even know what that is. I think it's quite obvious financially you're going to be impacted unless you're very well resourced. But do you think parenting has impacted your health as well or not? Let us know. 086 60 25000. Tell you what impact your health will impact your health: taking drugs. Finally, in the Mirror, Green Party TD Nessa Horgan has taken cocaine twice and ecstasy and has called for the decriminalisation of heroin. Can you imagine? We could be living in some strange society whereby you can legally end your life and legally, or not outside the law, take heroin. But anyway, in the new hot press today, because it's a hip magazine that asks TDs if they've taken drugs, the TD opens up about her rebellious past as a student. She talks frankly about taking cocaine and ecstasy, calls for the legalization of both marijuana and sex work, saying cocaine and heroin should be decriminalized. I'm not really sure she has a finger on the pulse of Irish society there. I could be wrong. Okay, right. We've our next guest in studio, and then we're going to be talking a reasonable amount about Leo Varadkar's decision to step away from being the head of Fine Gael and his role as Taoiseach. But that's coming up after these messages. Stay right where you are. Joined on the programme now by MEP Chris McManus, Midlands North West Sinn Féin rep, of course. Good morning to you. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning, Greg, and good morning to your listeners.
Right. You're visiting the constituency today. You heading to Aran Mór after this?
Yeah, heading to take that scenic route over towards Burtonport and get the ferry over to Aran Mór. Going into the local secondary school there, Garmscoil MacDiarmida. Beaten Warren Cavan as well. I think she's raised some very interesting points recently with her initiative of engaging with the minister. And then we move further down towards Killybegs, where obviously we will be with our local election candidate, Linda Boyle, where we will be meeting with local processors and producers.
We'll talk about that in a moment. I remember, I think it was the middle of last year, I read a quote from you, Chris, and you says, the new restoration law text strikes a balance for nature and farmers. And then, lo and behold, I note then that you decided to vote against the nature restoration law in the European Parliament. Why did you flip on that?
Well, I didn't flip on it. What we would have hoped in July last year when it was passed through the Parliament, and it's a very complex process, when Parliament will initially pass a piece of legislation, but that isn't like, unlike in Leinster House or the Oireachtas, where it then becomes law, it then has to go into further negotiations where it goes back to the Commission and the Council, where they will renegotiate it again to try and find a compromise that suits all three legs of the EU stool. And then it comes back to Parliament for basically a singular vote on whether you agree or disagree with it. The big issue for me has always been one of funding. I don't think you can keep asking farmers and rural communities to do more for less. It would have been our hope that during those inter-institutional discussions that there would have been some identification of where funding would come from, because quite often it seems to be an awful lot of stick and not enough carrot in regards to...
So what it was, what's outlined in it, you have no issue with, you can live with. It's the funding side of it?
It's the funding side of it, because, like, as I said at the end of it, and we worked...
But what if farmers in Donegal don't want to re-wet all of their lands?
Well, you see, in the first instance, what was important back in last July is that all aspects of it would be voluntary.
Mm-hmm.
That was key. So there would be nothing foisted upon farmers. The second thing was that, and it was actually an amendment from Sinn Féin, from myself, was that there would be, when a national restoration plan would be put in place, that there would be a socio-economic, look at how these things would impact. So you're not just looking at them exclusively.
But really it is still, though, sort of you saying that, you know, this is the direction we have to go. If farmers are on board with that, fair play to them, and we'll... you know, either help them diversify or help them out financially. Is that really what the Irish farmer wants?
No, well, I think sometimes there's been this perception of those who want to ensure we have be environmentally sustainable and the agri community are diametrically opposed, and they're not. I think an awful lot of farmers I talk to want to play their part, want to ensure that they see themselves as custodians and guardians of the land, and want to ensure that they have something to hand on to not only their own families in terms of generational renewal. And that is an issue of the next generation of farmers, because it's something that I come upon time and time again, is farmers who are actually saying they're not encouraging their kids to go into agriculture. And that's something we need to be very, very worried about. We have a very older cohort. We have the oldest age average of farming within the European Union. So I think farmers want to play their part. But again, you see, it goes back to this sense of frustration of continually being asked to do more for less, continuative administrative burden, continuative bureaucracy.
Mm. And it says, so is this your party's position?
Yes.
Because Lynn Boylan seemed to think it was great news. And also to you coalesce over there and vote with a group that you broke away from yourself, effectively. So it was only really you and Luke McFlanagan that voted against it. So
the political group, the left in the European Parliament that we're involved with, is what's referred to as a confederal group. We act not as a cohesive political group. We can vote whichever way we see fit. And at the end of the day, my first instinct is to protect the constituents in my constituency. And in that regards, having engaged with the wider farming community and having heard their vast concerns and their frustrations, I felt that they weren't being protected in this regards, and that I couldn't support it.
You say you're going to go out and meet Maureen, and you'll go down to Killybegs as well. Other than sort of say, sure, look, it's terrible what's going on, isn't it? What really can you tell them, or what commitments can you give them? Because we were speaking to Padraig McLaughlin earlier in the week, and he said quite firmly that Sinn Féin in government would appoint a junior minister with specific responsibility for the marine, and would be a strong voice advocating on behalf of fishermen. But then when you start getting down to the delivery, you know, how really could you get better deals for Ireland and what have you? That's when things start getting a little bit,
Yeah, because obviously, and I heard the interview on Tuesday morning, I was actually listening to it because it was the morning of the vote out in the European Parliament.
Well, you should be listening every morning, but anyway.
Well, there's a number of radio stations in my constituency of 13 counties, and as I said, I'd have to be growing multiple ears, Greg, in that regards. But I did listen to Pádraic on Tuesday morning, and I have to say, he's somebody who feels very passionate.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. You know, I'm not questioning.
You know, and as I said, his priority and his instinct is to protect coastal communities, not only in Donegal, but along the West Coast.
But just to get to it, not to cut across you, right, because it's important you heard as well, but, you know, it's about delivery, right? You know, and I also have a role here in managing expectations, I think, to some extent. So whilst it's very encouraging that you're going out to meet Maureen and her family, you know, really, your party can't commit that you will, you can say that you'll try till you're blue in the face, but an Irish government in situ, and not wishing to jump the gun here, cannot say to Maureen, you know, we will ensure that you were able to catch Pádraic on hooks.
No, and I appreciate
that. Do you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely, Greg. Like, as I said, nobody here has a magic wand. But I think what's required is, you know, focused leadership in this regards. In the first instance, what we need to see is a recalibration out in Europe of trying to ensure that there's fairness in all EU negotiations and that the CFP is re-looked at. Because, like, when we hear about, you know, that there's kind of secret discussions going on with a country like Iceland in regards to gaining access to waters in a country with significantly lower population than ourselves and being able to have
landlocked countries have better fishing rights than us.
Oh, yeah. And as I said, this has been something that successive governments, and as I said, I'm not trying to score political points here, but it has happened that we have seen the fishing community and coastal communities being thrown under the bus.
Yes, but you
in terms of the.
But my point is and listen, this is why maybe, you know, if you think you can make a difference, that's grand. But focus on stuff we can make changes on. You know, this government, for all the faults as some might see it, they do go out there and they try and secure the best deal for farmers and the best deal for fishing. If the truth be told, if you were the Minister for the Marine, okay, you probably couldn't have come back with a better deal over the lifetime of this government. Because we're deal takers. We're not really deal negotiators. We were effectively sacrificial lambs for the Brexit deal. And we stood by and let that happen. I don't think your party could have actually done anything different now.
Well, I would disagree, and I think it's a matter, again, and going back to one of political priorities. And in the first, like, look at domestically what we've seen in the last year, where the budget has the budget from 2023 to 2024 has been effectively halved in regards to supports for fishing communities. And if you're not setting the tone at a domestic level, it's very hard then to go out to Europe and try and play a different game and articulate differently. So I think in the first instance, what we need to have is a dedicated ministry for fisheries. What we need to see is that the budget that was slashed there in the last 12 months is brought back up to where it was and better. And then if we can do that and set the tone of showing that it's a department and a government that wants to work with the processors and the producers, then what we can do is go out to Brussels with a unified team. Like, when I became an MEP, one of the things an MEP can do is bring delegations out to Europe. And obviously, I became an MEP the first week of COVID, so for about 2 years, couldn't do it. But the very first delegation I brought out to Brussels was the fishing industry, a group of both the producers and the processors unified. And we bypassed the department, who seemed to be at times the gatekeepers in terms of information between the fishing industry here in Ireland and Brussels. And we went directly and we met with the commissioner. And that was important.
What came from that?
What came from that was that we were able to have a straight line of communication.
What benefit to the Irish fishing community was that, other than sort of, you know?
Well, look, all we can do is, in a very limited capacity, is to try and open doors.
Exactly, and it's very good, but that's the problem, you see, even on a national elected level in government, that's all you really can do anyway.
Well, no, because if you have then like a strong government that is going to take a strong political stance in regards to protecting whether it's agri or whether it's fisheries, is then to use the leverage at the European Council level to be able to fight the corner. Because, like, as I said, you indicated before, when it came to Brexit and during the negotiation process, the last thing that was looked at was the fisheries, and then it became the sacrificial lamb. And that's wrong. You know, we need to look at things more in the round, and we need to look at things in the bigger picture.
I just think that part of the deal, part of our position in Europe, and you know, things in the round are not negotiated sort of almost individually, like the Brexit, for an example, that really, you know, that is probably a decision that had to be made to get that deal over the line with the British, for an example. Do you know what I mean? And I just don't know if... And it remains to be seen, and we will see potentially, if a different government would actually be able to achieve...
Well, the point I would make is, and I'd go back to, as we referred to Pádraig's passion for fisheries earlier on, we're asking people to give us that chance. Give us that chance and give us that opportunity to step up to
the
market.
Is it frustrating for you as an MEP that Europe is thrown under the bus when it's a decision that's not good for Ireland, and the national government takes the credit when it is good for Ireland?
Yes and no. Look, I think we need... The first thing people need to realise is that Europe... And there's a sense, there's always that sense of disconnect, and I get this when I travel around the constituency and I'm engaging with people. The feel that Europe is, you know, it's out there somewhere. It doesn't really have a direct impact apart from, you know, certain things like fisheries and agriculture. And I have to say, they're the two sectors that are most invested and engaged with what goes on in Europe and know day-to-day what's going up to affect them. But people feel that sense of disconnect. I think when people are told that 70 to 80% of the legislation that comes through the Oireachtas is either EU-led or has EU fingerprints heavily all over it, when they realise that the decisions that are made out in Brussels do have a direct impact on them, it may be delayed because obviously things that we work on in Europe don't have an effect for maybe 12, 18, 24 months later in a national or state context.
I know one of the things, and we don't have very long, but I appreciate your time. One of the things you are keen on is the Right to Cash campaign. Now, this government in this country has its own sort of, some would say it's doing as much as it can. From a European perspective, though, really, the future seems to be in digital, the digital euro. You know, so in other words, this government is perhaps maybe looking after those that like cash more than the EU as a bloc actually is.
Well, at the minute, and I'm one of six MEPs who are working at the very initial legislation around, and we're working on the two of them in parallel, the right to cash and the digital euro. And I come from a viewpoint of that the right to cash has to be a fundamental, that we can't assume that all citizens want to use digital currencies, even though people may think that that is a general direction that... that our society is taking. I think there will always be a need for cash. It's a legal tender. We actually have carried out a survey and we got just shy of 4,000 respondents, and it's predominantly within the constituency areas where we targeted it. And interestingly, over half the respondents were in the 50 plus age range. I think we, as I said, we had 3,956. And overwhelmingly, people wanted the right to be able to use cash in their everyday existence. They want the choice.
Yeah.
In some instances, it's handy and convenient to be able to use electronic.
Yeah, but the thing about it is, and this is what I don't know the role in government or Europe is right? I want to go and watch an intercounty football match and I want to pay in cash.
Yeah.
I can't. I want to go to the Three Arena and I want to buy a pint in cash. I can't. I want to go into Vodafone and I want to buy a new handset in cash. I can't.
As I said,
should they all not be compelled to take cash?
No, and that's where we're working from, because at the minute where the governments they're coming from is they're saying we will allow the right not to use cash, but in some exceptions. Yeah. So they would say, like in certain things, groceries. Like you know, groceries or going to the pharmacy, you know, they have to be able to accept cash. Actually, the six of us MEPs who are working on it out in Europe, and we're hoping to get it through before the end of the current parliament, which is at the end of April, is we're coming from the viewpoint of the basic concept has to be the right to use cash everywhere, but there may be some exceptions. but that fundamentally it, we're coming at it from the right to use cash in all instances. So if you want to go in and buy...
So does it go beyond national law as it stands at the moment? Or what's being proposed at the moment?
Well, it does very much. And as I said, in EU law will supersede Irish law in this regard. Mm-hmm. So if the EU law comes at the fundamental viewpoint of you have the right to use cash, it is your basic right, it is legal tender, the Irish law and the Irish government will have to follow suit in that regard.
Listen, there's so much more I'd like to talk to you about. Obviously, Irish neutrality is a big issue at the moment. We've talked a little bit about what you're doing today. We'll not delay you any further. You're heading to Aranmore. I'm jealous. It's beautiful. Listen, have a safe trip and thanks for joining us. And
thanks very much. Thank you, Greg.
Okay, so as we revealed on the show yesterday, well, we didn't reveal it. We brought it to you on the show yesterday. Leo Varadkar is stepping down as Fine Gael leader, stepping down as Taoiseach. A new Fine Gael leader will be announced by Friday the 5th of April. There is expected to be a leadership contest following yesterday's announcement. Nominations for the next party leader will open this morning at 10 and close at 1 next Monday afternoon. We are joined by a couple of guests on this before 10 and we'll continue the conversation after 10 because there's a lot to work out here. I want to say good morning first to Deputy Joe McHugh. Good morning, Joe. Thanks for your time today.
No problem. Good morning. Thanks for asking me on.
You're on the record on this show on numerous occasions that obviously you have a professional relationship with Leo Varadkar, but you also count him as a friend. So I presume watching the emotional announcement yesterday, you know, you'd have felt very empathetic towards him.
Yeah, I think, like, to be honest, I think Leo, you know, holds his heart on his sleeve at times. And when I really got to know him, when I was Chief Whip appointed in 2017, got to know him very well around the cabinet table. And, you know, from a professional point of view, one thing that Leo did show was just a hunger for information. And no minister would arrive in before cabinet without being all over their brief because Leo would have read it the night before. So he was very, very thorough in relation to his role. He took his role very seriously. And, you know, he worked really, really hard. And I think as well, like, I know, like, politicians, we try to put ourselves out there that we work 7 days a week. We do that and we're on call 7 days a week. But I think Leo had a good approach. Like he managed to do to slot away time that he needed personal time. And I think he was good at that. And I think that resulted in him being more productive rather than being constantly available 7 days a week.
Did you have any indication this announcement was coming?
No, I didn't. And it's funny, when I got the first message, there was a WhatsApp thing going around saying there was going to be the earthquake news, and a few people from different media outlets contacted me. And, you know, my gut reaction was, this is fake news or somebody's just messing here. But then, you know, I rang a few members and, you know, there was a sense that, you know, that there was something big coming. And you know, within that 2 hour period from 10 to 12, like there was a lot of speculation and a lot of interest. And as you know yourself, like you would have been, you know, getting different messages about it as well.
What do you think of how he announced it in that, you know, paraphrasing, he doesn't really think he's the right person to give the candidates the best chance in the locals and the general election, which perhaps I presume now most likely will be early next year. I don't know what the strategy of Fine Gael might be in that regard, but I mean, he was clear. It's funny because he is quite intelligent, of course he is, in that he addressed an awful lot of the speculation that was happening in advance of the announcement and would happen. In other words, there's no backstory here. There's no particular reason. He just felt he wasn't the right person to lead the party. But it's still, it's strange timing, isn't it?
Well, it isn't, it isn't. Even if, you know, okay, the both referendums was a you know, an incredible defeat for the government, and I think Leo would have taken that very personally. I didn't speak to him after the referendums, but knowing Leo, he would have had a sense of responsibility there in terms of the scale of the defeat. And even though he did such a good job in Washington, and he really, really brought the voice of the people of Ireland to Washington and to Joe Biden and to the American administration in relation to Gaza, and the feedback was quite positive in relation to his intervention. And while all that was happening, I'd say at the back of his mind, Leo had his, I'd say, you know, speculating and having spoken to him, he would have had his mind made up maybe in the aftermath or maybe in advance of the referendum if he knew it was going to go in the way that it did. So he wanted to give advance, you know, there is a small window here, there's a short window, but there was the Easter break coming up, so he would have made that calculation around the Easter break, and there is a very, very real opportunity now to have a contest done and dusted before the Dáil resumes.
Do you think there will be a contest? Because, I mean, it's clear, and listen, there's a bit of strategy to it, and you know how it works. The voices, some really strong voices have come out in favour of Simon Harris. Now, to me, it feels like even though there might be other strong candidates there, that, you know, if you were to contest against him now, it could actually be politically damaging. You'd always be seen as someone who lost a leadership election. And we know the swing the senators and TDs have. Do you think his is the only name that will go forward? I can't see how this would work well for any other of the sort of key figures in Fine Gael for their careers and their reputations to stand against him.
Well, I suppose I came into the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party in 2002. At the moment, I'm outside the Parliamentary Party, but since 2002, there were two previous leadership contests. I think the leadership contest between Enda Kenny and Richard Bruton made Enda stronger. I think that was good. I was very much involved in Leo's leadership contest with Simon Coveney. It was a very, very positive campaign internally for the party. I thought it was really, really important.
Was it really? Because Coveney beat him 2-1 in the general votes, the membership votes. And then Leo Varadkar obviously swept the board in the vote, which I think, what's it, 65% between elected reps. So was it really that big a win for him, considering the grassroots perhaps went for Coveney?
Well, look,
that's rightly history or wrongly, now, I suppose. It's history at this point, yeah.
Yeah, rightly or wrongly, I suppose the weight of the voting, the electoral colleges within the parliamentary party. So, like, you know, Leo would have won that hands down. So, you know, go back to your question, will there be an election? If I was speculating, there possibly will be. I think it would be good to have a contest. And I think if Simon Harris is the front runner at the minute, I think even he'll be thinking in his own mind that maybe a contest would be good just to copper fasten his position.
I get you, but who's going to be the sacrificial lamb to copper fashion his position? I mean, Simon Coveney effectively said he wouldn't be entering the race because he'd already contested one and lost. If I were a Pascal Donoghue or what have you, I'd be reading the lie of the land and keep, you know, I'd be riding it out to the next opportunity personally. But anyway, we'll see. If you had a vote, Joe, which way would you go?
Well, I don't know, because we don't know the runners and riders.
You know the possible four or five. Like, are you a...
Not really. There's one thing about politics. There's always such a thing as a dark horse, or somebody could be blindsided by somebody. So I think, like, look, for two reasons. Out of respect to people who may not be in the media shortlist at the minute, and secondly, you know, as you say, like it would be a hypothetical.
Well, let me ask you: do you think the party needs to sort of identify someone that speaks more to the people, that maybe is more Middle Ireland, if you know what I mean, that more traditional type candidate? Because that seems to be, and I think the message was sent to you to the government very clearly through the referenda, that it's like, hold on a second, you know, we're progressive, we're inclusive, but also let's not forget where we come from here.
Yeah, look, you know, there's always going to be issues to do with the Constitution. There's always going to be issues to do with the social agenda. But I mean, there is very much a focus in Ireland in the moment that the economics is where the focus is at. There's people struggling financially, and whoever comes in will be very, very will be very wise to bring that as their main agenda, because it is the issue. And you know, the message from the referendums was that, you know, people were asking the questions, was it even needed in the first place to even put the question to the people? But I think there has to be a recalibration in terms of what the real issues are.
Right, and very finally, then, and a change of leadership might allow that. Very finally, I can't get you to sort of favour someone that you'd like to see lead the party that you may or may not return to.
Yeah, and I think, I suppose, there's another added, I suppose, complexity to my situation. Like, whoever, like, say if there's two or three runners, or say, for example, I suppose, logically, the there'll either just be one or possibly two. So say if there's two, I will be reaching out to both of those candidates, because I do vote with the government on the major issues. And my one issue is MiCA, and I will be putting that question to both candidates, of whoever they are, at the beginning of the race.
Thanks for your time, Joe. I appreciate it. That's Deputy Joe McHugh, our political analyst, one of them too. Paddy Rooney joins us on the programme now. Paddy, thanks so much for taking the call this morning.
You're welcome.
An interesting comment you made, that it's too early really to see how history might remember Leo Varadkar, but you believe down the line it will be favourable?
I think so. It's very difficult to judge, I suppose, what the balance sheet of any Taoiseach is. But a lecturer in DCU, David O'Keefe, wrote an article some time ago about how do you actually define a good statesman, and it's going to be far, far too early, I think, to write that yet about Leo Varadkar. But I suppose the big thing anyway is that any political leader in any jurisdiction, Greg, they only get to deal with about two or three major big-ticket items, and it depends how they actually deal with those. And the commentary, or the constant commentary over the last 18 hours or so since he announced his resignation, is that the three big-ticket items for him was about Brexit, was about the social issues about that he gave the Irish people what they wanted in relation to the repeal of the Eighth Amendment and same-sex marriage. Now, remember, he didn't introduce that. It was the people that decided that through a referendum, but he set the scene. And the other one then was about the management of COVID. I mean, whatever wants to say, I know that we're going to have an inquiry or review about how things were managed, but we did, by and large, manage it reasonably well in the round, not the chaotic way that the British government did, Boris Johnson and Matt Hancock, and not the chaotic way that they did in the United States. But time, I think, we need time to distill this and to think about it before we start making our judgments on them.
What direction do you think Fine Gael need to go next? Obviously, there are going to be the cries that, you know, the public should get a chance to choose who leads the country, and not these three parties for the third time effectively picking the Taoiseach themselves. We know which way it's going to go. What way do you think it should go?
Well, first of all, Mary Lou McDonald and Holly Cairns and Ivana Bacik are making a lot of noise about the fact that it shouldn't be a cabal of a small number of people within the Fine Gael organisation who decides a Taoiseach. Well, I've got news for them. I mean, this state is 102 years old, Greg, and the people have never actually elected or decided the Taoiseach. It's actually Dáil Éireann that decides, and then the approved by the Senate. We've had about six Taoiseach appointed in the history of this state that have been swapped in mid-cycle without a general election. Leo Varadkar himself actually came into the position without a general election, first off. And we've had a lot of people that came completely out of the blue. I mean, John A. Costello in 1948, John Bruton in 94. Who would ever have thought after the 2020 election that Micheál Martin would end up with Taoiseach? So the people never decided. So that's a complete nonsense. And I think what's going to happen here, it'll probably be Simon Harris. Unlikely that there'll be a contest, I suspect. I know Joe was talking about possible runners and riders or alternative ones. I don't think there's going to be a contest, for the simple reason is that there isn't time. And I think as well that there isn't going to be a huge amount of change within Fine Gael, because there's a whole load of things that are sort of set in stone. For instance, the budget has already been set and agreed. A lot of the legislative framework has been set and agreed for 2024. And I think the Fine Gael Ardéis is coming up in the early days of April. That's not that long away. I think that the party needs to have somebody in place for all of those. And I suppose what's going to happen then, you know, you were trying to press Joe there about the possibility of a general election later on this year. I think what's going to happen there, that's not in, it's probably going to be Simon Harris, I suspect. And I don't think it's in his gift, because it'll depend what's going to happen in the European elections on the 7th of June. If there are some TDs, for instance, that are elected and there is a whole slew of by-elections to take place, I mean, governments very seldom win by-elections, if my memory serves me right, since Fine Gael came to power in 2011, the government have actually won two by-elections at that time. That was Patrick Nulty and Gabriel McFadden. So the likelihood is that they're going to lose all of those. It would look very, very bad, and it would have a reverse momentum, I think, for any party if you were to lose about four or five by-elections. So the mood music is, I think, that the government may be forced into possibly an October or November election.
All right, brilliant stuff as always, Paddy. We look forward to chatting to you again as this develops. Thank you so very much indeed, Paddy Rooney there.